Conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Where do you go and who do you call if you've been a victim of crime? We're not talking about the police. We're talking about dealing with the longer-term impact of crime. Maybe you need legal help or perhaps even other kinds of support. Well, this is National Crime Victims' Rights Week, and tonight we take a look at what happens to victims of crime after the police are gone. My guests are Naida Hinau, head of engagement for the Network for Victim Recovery of D.C., and Dr. Tanya Stafford Manning, advocate, human trafficking survivor, and rescuer. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at H. Fisher, WHUR, or you can find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Dr. Stafford Manning, Naida Hinau, thank you both for joining the conversation.
Thank you for having us. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Ms. Hinau, let me first ask you, when you talk about victims of crime, can you kind of characterize who we're talking about?
Yes, of course. Well, when we're talking about victims of crime as it relates to National Crime Victims Rights Week, we're talking about not only the person that has been directly affected by the crime, so the person that we more traditionally would think of as the victim, but it also extends to the victim's loved ones when we're talking about homicide. So in that case, the victim has passed away, but their rights and their ability to access resources extends to their surviving family members and loved ones so that they're able to receive support as well.
Do you believe that in some cases, victims of crime are overshadowed by the actual perpetrator of the crimes, particularly, say, in news coverage and the legal system, where so much emphasis is placed on putting the perpetrator of the crime away?
Thank you so much for posing that question. Yes, we find that often news coverage doesn't center the experience of the person who actually experienced the harm, and instead kind of will tend to sensationalize or obsess about the details about the person who caused harm. And what we're really losing there is the victim's unique voice, because the thing is that victims all aren't not the same. They're not coming from the same life experiences, the same communities, or nor do they have the same goals. And so by focusing on the person who caused harm, we're losing an opportunity for that person to tell us their story and how it's impacted them, and to also be able to hear as a community about the ways that victims want to feel supported and the resources that they need when something like this has happened. So I think that's definitely the case. And while it is important to talk about people causing harm for prevention and education, we can't forget about the people who are actually going through this when we're talking about community safety.
Speaking of telling stories, Dr. Manning, as I mentioned in the introduction, you are a human trafficking survivor. Can you briefly tell us your story, particularly as it relates to the tail end and the kind of support and help you needed?
So my journey started at the age of 13, being sold by my mom for drugs right here in Dallas, Texas, because I'm from Dallas. And the man that bought me kept me for 10 years. While in captivity, I had three kids. In those 10-year span, I went to three different hospitals and nobody said anything. And because they didn't know what to say, they didn't know how to say it. And I was raped, beaten, and almost killed by him before I was rescued by my neighbor. My neighbor is the one that had seen something, said something, and she did something. So I always say, not only that day did she save my life, but she saved three other lives, and that was my three children, which is three generations. So you save one, you save a generation. The help and support that I received after being rescued was, I was immediately put in trauma-informed therapy. We didn't even know about trauma-informed therapy back then, back in the early 90s. But people were getting educated and therapists was getting educated about the past trauma and the post-trauma that we all receive before we're even in a traumatic situation.
What is trauma, if I may ask, what is trauma-informed therapy?
Well, a trauma-informed therapist is a therapist that focuses on, like, TBI, the brain, how the brain works, and the trauma that the brain suffers. As, like, my trauma stopped at 13. So at 13, that's where I was at. Like, I was stuck for a while. Even though I was a mother, I was stuck for a while. And so trauma-informed therapy is a therapist that focuses on the trauma itself and not just getting you to the next level or saying, oh, you'll be okay, or just give you medication and different things like that. I've never been put on medication, never had any psychological issues or anything like that, because I had great therapists that specialized in trauma.
You said that you were held for 10 years, so you were rescued at 23. How old are you now?
I am about to be 50 in November.
Oh, congratulations. It's a milestone, trust me.
It is.
But it is. From 23 to, you know, 49.9, you know, talk to me about the importance of the kind of support, because certainly all crimes are different. Yours was obviously horrific and severe, but some people need more support than others. Some need less in different kinds. But from your perspective, obviously you become a voice and advocate. But at what point did you pull back from the support and turn that around to be the advocate that you are today?
I never pulled back from the support. I got continued support, and that's what survivors and victims of crime need. So even in my program, I have an organization called It's Going to Be Okay, and we are a program that service victims of crime, trafficking, and we help the whole family. So my program is 2 years plus, and I say 2 years plus because they stay in the safe house for 2 years. If they want to stay, if they want to stay longer, they can stay. We don't kick them out. We don't force them to leave. If they're not ready, they're not ready. So continued support, we do wraparound services where we provide them with housing stability, education, life skills, everything that they need. So I never pull back from the support at all. And to this day, I'm still in counseling. I go every Thursday, so therapy Thursday for me. But there's different challenges in our lives. And then doing what I do, rescue, restore, and rebuild, I always need the help and support, not just of therapy, but my family, my children, my grandchildren. So my support never went away, and that's what we have to realize about victims and human trafficking survivors. We have to always elevate them, engage them, and then do some change with them, you know, effective change. And that means calling upon all of our communities to get involved, but the thing is you got to believe them. Survivors need, they need an environment where survivors have the confidence that they will be heard, believed, and supported.
Yeah, I think
we get that. We're good.
I think you make an excellent point, Dr. Tanya Stafford Manning. Thank you so much for being a part of this conversation. I appreciate your help. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about getting help for victims of crime after the police are gone. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Joining the conversation now is Navarro Ney Archie, victim witness coordinator for the Prince George's County State's Attorney's Office. Ney, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. I want to ask you the same thing that I asked Ms. Hanau earlier. When you look at victims of crime, and we have seen not only in the District of Columbia but also Prince George's County an incredible rise in all kinds of crimes, obviously, you know, homicides, robberies, carjackings, and the like. Talk to me about the work that you're doing in Prince George's County.
Yes. Again, thank you for having me.
Sure.
Another rise in crime that you did not mention that we are seeing becoming more volatile in Prince George's County is domestic violence. Domestic violence, you know, even before the pandemic began, it was increasing, and during the pandemic, it went to exponential lengths. And then even post-pandemic, the domestic violence is still very much so present, and again, becoming more increasingly violent. So with our office, I'm a part of the victim witness unit within Prince George's County State's Attorney's Office. And within our unit, we assist victims of various capacities. It does not matter the crime. It does not matter how you were victimized. If you were victimized in Prince George's County, we can assist you. And that goes for the people that are not residents of Prince George's County. We have coordinators that assist with the judicial process, explaining to them the process, more importantly, explaining to them their rights, which includes their rights to be present at every hearing. We provide mental health referrals, therapy referrals. And also what I love about, not being biased, of course, but what I love about our office is we also have housing coordinators like myself that assist with relocation. We assist with gift cards and furniture and food. We enroll people in various safety programs. And we also collaborate with other entities throughout the county to, again, help us, you know, maximize the available resources and cater those resources to each victim.
Mm-hmm. I have lots of questions for both of you, and our listeners do as well. But before I get to more questions, I need both of you, and I'll start with Ms. Hanau, to just share some resources for victims of crime who may need help. They may still be feeling the impacts of a crime perpetrated upon them weeks or even months after it happened. So I throw some resources out there, a website or something like that. I'll start with you, Ms. Hanau.
Yes, I'd like to really highlight the DC Victim Hotline. And the reason for that is that by reaching out to the DC Victim Hotline, folks can get connected to a significant number of local nonprofits, and so it kind of takes out the legwork for the victim. The other benefit is that the DC Victim Hotline is a 24/7 hotline, so that folks can be able to be connected as soon as possible and don't have to wait around after business hours. And so the number for that is 1-844-443-5732. 1-844-443-5732, and folks can actually text that number as well or chat with them online at dcvictim.org. And by connecting to the DC Victim Hotline, you can connect with my organization, again, the Network for Victim Recovery of DC, that provides free services regardless of how much money you make. That's very important, because some folks may have an abusive spouse who makes a lot of money, or maybe a child who has abusive parents who make a lot of money and may not be eligible for services at other organizations. But you will be eligible at NVRDC. But again, by connecting to the DC Victim Hotline, they'll connect you to us or to a variety of other providers if you have different types of needs. So that's a really great resource that I would recommend everyone save to their phones now, just in case anything were to ever happen to you or someone else, that you have that number available and don't have to be searching in a moment of crisis.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Archie, same question. Offer some resources that our listeners can use prior to us going to the break in a minute or so.
Okay. Referring back, to the domestic violence, with the increase in the surge in those crimes, one of our most prominent resources is the Prince George's County Family Justice Center. I call it the one-stop shop. There are over 20 agencies within this one building. Even with people that don't have cars, they have transportation. All of the services in this building are free. We're speaking both criminal and civil. Attorneys are there. The sheriff's office, the state attorney's office, Prince George's County Police Department, Department of Human Services, Department of Family Services. I mean, a ton of services is in this one building. They are located on the same street as the Upper Marlboro Courthouse. Their number is 301-780-8008. Again, this is Prince George's County Family Justice Center. They do have extended hours on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. I believe Saturday they will, their hours will begin 10 a.m. to 10 p.m., if I'm not mistaken. But if I can highlight one resource that we utilize daily, it would definitely be Prince George's County Family Justice Center. And they assist with domestic violence, sexual assault, elder abuse, human trafficking, all of those things, you know, within that realm. If you are victimized or not even sure if you have been victimized, because, you know, the younger generation, they may have questions of what that is, you can definitely call that center or go to that center. They are a walk-in facility.
Okay.
You can go to that center and get the help that you need.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk more about resources for victims of crime long after the crime was committed. This is National Crime Victims Rights Week, so stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Your calls are next. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. This is National Crime Victims Rights Week. And tonight we're taking a look at what happens to victims of crime after the police are gone. My guests are Naida Hinau, Head of Engagement for the Network for Victim Recovery of D.C., and Navarro Ney Archie, Victim Witness Coordinator for the Prince George's County State's Attorney's Office. Lines are open at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Curtis, calling from Landover. Thanks for hanging on, Curtis. What's on your mind? Curtis, are you there? Curtis, give me a call back if you can. I want to go back to you, Ms. Hinau. You said something that, you know, struck me when you were talking about the victims of crime, you know, telling their story. I would imagine that is not really the first thing that kind of comes to mind, but even if that, even, you know, symbolically making sure that they are represented and cared for and supported, how do they know that these resources are there? For it, you know, for example, if under the worst circumstances, and there are so many different kinds of crimes, as you know, but let us say that a family member is murdered, and, you know, what role does your office play in supporting the family, the surviving family members?
Yes, of course, and you touched on a lot of great points. I think the first point of how do victims know that these resources or that they have rights, right? A lot of people are familiar with, like, oh, if I get arrested, I have my Miranda rights. But very few people know that if they become a victim or if a family member becomes a victim of a crime, that they have rights as well. So it is very important to have awareness that rights do exist and that resources are available. And then more specifically to your question about homicide victims, this is something that, you know, we keep hearing local politicians talk about increasing crime rates and everything else and concern about public safety. But at the same time, we're seeing a budget cut of 31% to the D.C. Office of Victim Services and Justice Grants, which provides funding for organizations like mine that do really critical work in supporting these families. Our services can include everything from having an attorney that's able to provide free advice to them and free representation if they want to go to the police or if they want to go in the criminal legal system. And even if they don't, they can get them connected to things like restorative justice as well. Or an alternative, if they're like, you know what, our priority is not the legal system right now, we want to focus on getting ourselves back together. Some folks may want to prioritize mental health referrals, which we can do through our advocacy program. We can set them up with new housing if they're no longer feeling safe in case the murder took place in their home, or if perhaps if they've had property damage, like maybe someone knocked down a door or shot at windows. All of those things are things that my organization and similar organizations can help support, either by doing a crime victim compensation application or helping with restitution motions, or even something as simple, you know, as funeral costs. Funeral costs are something that are often overlooked when we talk about homicide, but those can get very expensive. And when we forget about victims, we forget about that additional burden in addition to the trauma that Dr. Manning talked about earlier. But there's financial realities as well. There may be physical realities if there are any injuries, et cetera. And so it is very important to uplift that and these important resources that are there to support, again, not only victims, but their families as well, but especially at a time where we're seeing these increasing crime rates but aren't seeing the funding from the city to support the continuation of those services.
I guess what I'm talking about, however, again, and all of those things are really important, but I'm talking about the logistics of it, because if I am the surviving family member of a homicide, do you call me? If I'm in court watching the arraignment, does somebody from your office come up to me? If I don't know, what happens? I mean, what is exactly. How does that work?
Yes. So in theory, we have a lot of our clients that reach us because of referrals. So either because they end up at a different organization who can't help them and they come to us, or because the detective or officer that responded to the scene connects them to us, or similarly prosecutors or even judges will connect them back to us because they're familiar with our services. But it is really hard to get the word out that we exist, because again, like, most people don't end up getting connected to anyone that's helpful, or some people just kind of assume like, okay, the only option that I have is going to the police and I don't feel safe doing so I'm not going to reach out for help, I'm not going to do anything else. And so that's why word of mouth can be such a powerful tool for just folks to spread the word that things like this do exist, and again, spreading the word about the DC Victim Hotline so that folks can get connected to resources like us, because information really is power here, and to know that you do not have to go through this alone and there are systems in place to support you, and that, again, the police is not the only option. It is not that you're coming to us and we're like, okay, we're going to help you file your police report and tell you what to do. No, every victim is different, and what may be right for them, like, they get to decide that. We don't. We take a trauma-informed approach that was mentioned earlier, and, like, really being mindful to what that specific victim has gone through and what they want to achieve, and then supporting them in achieving that.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about help for victims of crime. This is National Crime Victims Rights Week. Let's go to Michelle, calling from Maryland. Michelle, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, what's on my mind is a crime occurred that happened to my granddaughter while she was visiting my house. And she and her mom are D.C. residents. The crime happened in Maryland. They're D.C. residents. They have D.C. insurance. But because it happened in Maryland, it's hard for us to get the assistance that we really needed because of the fact that they are D.C. residents. We were offered some assistance, but because it happened in my house, I'm a victim as well. And I had to actually pay for my assistance, although I was considered a victim as well. They say the help is out there, but... okay, here you have my daughter who lives in D.C. The person lives in D.C. that committed the crime, but it happened in Maryland. So now my daughter, she, you know, was trying to get assistance with her rent and things like that, because psychologically it really affected her to where, you know, she lost time off her job and things like that. The help was not there. D.C. don't want to help because they say it happened in Maryland. Maryland can only help her so much because she's a D.C. resident. Mm. They keep saying there's help out there for victims, but it's, the help isn't really out there. And even with the help that is out there, it's very limited.
Well, Michelle, let me see if Nay can try to address that. Nay, you kind of touched on this issue early in the conversation when you're talking about cross-jurisdictional issues.
Yes. Hi, Ms. Michelle. A lot of times in our office, actually... Can you hear me?
Okay.
No, you're very long.
Okay, yeah, let's turn Nay Archie up just a little bit. Please go right ahead.
I'm sorry, is it better now?
Michelle, yes. Can you hear?
Yes.
Okay, go right ahead.
Hi, Ms. Michelle. So with our office, we deal with cross-jurisdiction every single day. And you are right, there are some limitations. However, I'm not sure, and I don't want to quite get into specifics of what it is you're looking for, but I know with our office, and just speaking from experience, because, again, this is my job and, you know, what I do, when you've been victimized in Prince George's County, it does not matter where your residency is because the crime occurred here. Speaking specifically with the Prince George's County State's Attorney's Office, we have in-house resources that you are eligible for separate and apart from your granddaughter in which the direct crime occurred with. But because it occurred in your home, you are to consider victimized. So even, let's just say, things with like relocation or things like, you know, you're needing assistance with therapy or, you know, things of that nature. Even though they are D.C. residents, we have the tools and we have the partnership with various agencies to get you connected to getting those resources. And if I may, to just touch on a question that you asked before, you say to how do people know about these resources? Again, with our office, one of the things that we do is we go around to various police law enforcement agencies, whether it is the police department, the state police, the park police. We go around to these agencies and we provide in-service training on victims' rights and victim services. One of the things that our office is working on is providing like little information cards and QR codes so that way when you do encounter the police, they can provide you with the information to contact us, as well as if you are ever in our courtroom, when we contact you for your court hearing, we also provide you with information regarding resources. We see what resources you need, where you are with obtaining resources if you try to do it on your own. And it's a collaborative effort, but we do get it done.
Michelle, let me...
That coming from PG County. I live in Howell County.
Okay.
Let me put that out there.
Right. Okay, well, that's it. Well, hold on, Michelle. Well, that's helpful. Ms. Archie, do you know whether or not Howard County has a similar kind of support system that you may be able to offer Michelle?
I don't know specifics, but what I can let you know, Ms. Michelle, is every state's attorney's office
She says every state's attorney's office has an office similar to the one that she has in Prince George's County. So I think maybe the best thing to do would be to call the Howard County State's Attorney's Office to find out whether or not there are any resources that may be able to assist you, Michelle.
Because I have done that. They've given me that. And those resources do not help as much as they say that they do. That's what I was calling about.
I see. Ms. Hanau, before we let Michelle go, do you have any possible words of encouragement? Obviously, these are jurisdictional issues, and no one here can obviously speak for Howard County or any other jurisdiction that you don't represent. But please go ahead.
Of course.
Well, first of all, just want to acknowledge that this sounds like a very frustrating and difficult situation, and so I'm sorry that you're going through that. And I, as I mentioned before, you know, everyone in the DMV region is kind of used to these cross-jurisdictional issues just because we're all so close together. And so I would recommend that even if the crime did take place in Maryland, maybe reaching out to D.C. organizations as well, because if the folks involved are D.C. residents, there may be assistance that you're able to receive. And so, you know, it might be difficult and frustrating at this point, but maybe trying someone new may be helpful or maybe more in line with the support that you're looking for. But again, so sorry to hear that is a frustrating experience. And unfortunately, we do see that there is a lot of this burden placed on the victims and the folks that have been harmed to look around for resources. And we do what we can to partner with others to make sure that burden is alleviated.
Michelle, I'm so sorry that we could not have been of more assistance. But as Ms. Hanau said, with your granddaughter being a D.C. resident, maybe there may be a way to link the services that you may also need through your granddaughter. That D.C. victim hotline is 844-443-5732. And as always, this information will be posted on our website on whur.com after 8:30 tonight. So, Michelle, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. And certainly we wish you the very best. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. You know, Ms. Hanau, to, you know, Michelle's point, when we just look at when we just look at the headlines and the complexities of the care that victims of crime need afterwards, it seems to be a rather daunting task. But you spoke about legal rights. Now, obviously, we understand about resources, but what legal rights might a crime victim have?
Yes, there's a lot of them, and D.C. is unique in that there are rights under federal law, under Crime Victims' Rights Act, and local law, the D.C. Crime Victim Bill of Rights. So some of those rights, just to give you a sense, include, for example, the right to privacy. So, for example, if the person who caused harm is looking to subpoena or receive documents relating to, like, the victim's private records, like employment records, educational records, mental health records, like perhaps your therapist's notes from your sessions, that sometimes happens, and so you have a right to privacy and are able to request that those subpoenas are blocked or that information is redacted. Something else is the right to notice. So simply just being notified of, like, hey, there's a hearing tomorrow involving your case, or there's a sentencing taking place in 2 weeks from now, just to let you know so that you're able to participate if you want. Also, the right to confer, which is very important. And so that basically means that with big moments, like, for example, if a prosecutor is going to make a plea offer to the person who caused you harm, you have the right to talk to that prosecutor before that offer is made and be told, like, this is what we're going to offer, and for you to say how you feel about it. And again, that's the reason that that's so important is, again, at the end of the day, a criminal trial is happening because someone was harmed, and that person should be at the very center of what is being considered in relation to that harm. They shouldn't be simply a witness or a piece of evidence. They should be centered as much as possible. And what those rights are trying to do is to provide that centering. So another right, for example, is the right to be heard during the sentencing stage of a criminal trial. And during that part, you can provide what's called a victim impact statement and to tell a judge before they rule on the case to say, like, hey, judge, this is what I've been through. Let me tell you what I've experienced and hear it directly from me. And this is, again, maybe what I've gone through mentally, economically, physically, and to be able to just have the opportunity for them to tell their story, which can be so empowering. And for some folks, they're not able to necessarily read it out loud themselves, so they may have a crime victim's rights attorney, like myself, read it for them, or to have the prosecutor or friend or family member read it. But it is still so powerful because it is one of the few moments where a victim is able to use their own words to convey their story and to be heard in the courtroom. But again, those are just some of the rights, and there are several under both local and federal law.
Ms. Archie, from your perspective, what kinds of obstacles have you found in trying to administer this help to crime victims? Because we're talking about someone who has been traumatized in one way, shape, or form. What kind of challenges do you face? Because I would imagine in some cases they may be as hard to deal with as the crime itself.
Yes. So I feel like one of the hardest challenges that we are facing right now is actually getting through that trauma. When victims are traumatized, especially if they've already been working on their case or trying to, acknowledge or press charges or whatever the case may be as far as their crime, their victimization, I feel like the biggest challenge is getting through that trauma and providing hope. A lot of victims, when they come to us, it could have been things that, you know, they tried to reach out to other agencies to get assistance before it had gotten to this this point of victimization. And just because they've just been misled or misinformed, or even if they misheard, trying to now, you know, assist them as best as possible and letting them know, like, no, we are here. There are tons of knowledgeable people that are here. We're ready, we're willing, we're able to assist you. But just getting through that barrier of I don't believe you, I feel like it's the biggest hurdle that, you know, victim advocates like myself and, attorney advocates are having to fight through, is that hurdle of I don't believe you, I don't trust you, and you're asking me to trust you in my most vulnerable state.
You know, one of the things that, you know, occurred to me, and this is for both of you, and I'll start with Ms. Hanau, is that, as we know, the criminal justice system is imperfect. But, you know, even in the case of violent crime, we do know that a perpetrator of a violent crime, particularly if it's a crime against a person or a person at home, it is possible that that person could be released on bail and the like. And I think one of the most horrifying things, Ms. Hanau, is if someone that you've never seen before, did not know, had no connection to you whatsoever, has perpetrated a crime against you, particularly, for example, if it's like a sexual assault, and for whatever reason that person is out pending trial, what role might your office have in providing support for the victim of that crime, you know, in the event that they may run into that person?
Yeah, that's so great, because even if statistically we do see that it is significantly more likely for someone that you know to cause you harm, there are circumstances where it is a complete stranger, and that can be very scary for folks. And so one of the possibilities that comes up are civil protection orders, which are kind of like restraining orders. And those are for circumstances where they might not know the person very well, but may know that, you know, they work somewhere or they go to school somewhere. And so that restraining order gives the similar type of protections of telling that person, don't come near me, don't come near my work, etc. But most often what we do when it's a complete stranger and there's no information known about them is providing support around safety and security for that survivor. So finding them alternate housing if that would make them feel safer, or if not, helping them with funds to get new locks or a security system, or finding if there's any other relocation services available to them, and also seeing if they need to do any like safety planning to say, like, okay, if I'm feeling scared, this is what I'm going to do. And as well as mental health support, because a lot of it too is just taking a toll on the mental health of survivors to be in that constant state of fear and adrenaline. And so making sure that as well as physical safety, we're checking in about mental safety as well, and being able to address both concurrently. And again, being able to be cognizant of the particular set of safety concerns that that victim has. Because as I mentioned earlier, for example, if having a police do a check-in just make sure that you're okay, it works for one person, that may not be appropriate for the person who doesn't feel safe around a police officer.
Ms. Archie, same issue. Your thoughts about, you know, the possibilities that somebody could run into the perpetrator of a crime against their person or their property?
Echoing a lot of what Michelle just stated.
Naida. But
I mean, excuse me.
That's quite all right. Go right ahead.
Echoing a lot of what she just stated, it is definitely we center, regardless if we relocate you or not, everything that we do is always centered around safety planning. But speaking with, you know, you running into someone, the first things that we always think of is, do you want to be relocated? If you own your home, are there any safety measures that we can, you know, beef up for you, whether that be security cameras or alarm systems? Oftentimes people don't get those because the upfront cost is so much. So if we take care of that and you just take care of the reoccurring bill, then that also, you know, helps alleviate the additional stress. I love the address confidentiality program. There are several address confidentiality programs throughout the U.S., including the District of Columbia, D.C. And what I love about it is it shields your address. So even when you depend, each state has their own requirement for the program. Speaking specifically of Maryland, the program is called Safe at Home. And your address changes even when you go to the DMV to get your new driver's license or your new license. This address, federal address, which is located in Annapolis, is located on your ID. So just knowing that no one can access your address through public records provides an additional layer of security for victims when they relocate. So again, just relocation, safety planning, if you need security system or cameras, we assist with that. If you need, we really cater our resources to each victim. But for the most part, once we provide these options, it's instant gratification when that victim takes a sigh of relief to know that they can be shielded and removed from that area. And again, going back, echoing again, the protective orders or peace orders, all of these things we explore. And if the victim is eligible for it, they can have it all.
Speaking of eligibility, the state's attorney has extended resources to those crime victims outside of the county. But what are the requirements for them utilizing those resources?
As long as the crime occurred in Prince George's County, that is the basic eligibility. So for, again, like for Miss Michelle, that's where I got that name from.
Right.
Mm-hmm. From Miss Michelle that was on the phone and how she was speaking of her granddaughter being victimized in Howard, but they are D.C. residents. We have that so often. You know, we right here, we border D.C. So it's so often we have D.C. residents that are being victimized in Prince George's County. So if the crime occurred in Prince George's County, you are deemed eligible, and then we will then begin to look at specific resources to see what else can we add on to. But as far as our office, as long as the crime occurred here in Prince George's County, we can assist you.
Mm-hmm.
I met people that were victimized that was from Georgia, you know, North Carolina. And, you know, granted, they may have to come back up here for their hearing, but nevertheless, we are still able to provide them with resources because, again, the crime occurred here.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Hanau, are there crime victims who are more likely to slip through the cracks than not? And if so, who are they? And how are you attempting to reach them?
Yes. Unfortunately, folks that are marginalized or who have are of an underserved demographic will tend to slip through the cracks. And those tend to be, for example, youth. We're one of the very few that provide specialized legal services for youth survivors in the district. Also elderly survivors, we also provide support to them. And oftentimes this is because folks are just not thinking of them as the main type of victim, especially with elders. That's just not what the stereotype is about what a victim looks like. And for that reason, a lot of the signs that that person is being victimized go unnoticed. But also a lot of residents of Ward 7 and 8 and folks that are black or brown and tend to be like from they're also like immigrant survivors, just because a lot of these folks are facing a lot of significant barriers, as I mentioned before, with communities that either historically have not received access to services generally, whether it's housing and food, etc., but also may have tense relationships with the police and other forms of government, or may have tense relationships with schools. Because of that, they will tend to see these systems as systems that they cannot trust and not feel safe in, and with a lot of reason, right? And so up until now, or up until more recently, people have been very reluctant to talk about possible supports for crime victims that do not look like what we've been doing for the last hundreds and hundreds of years. And because of that, those folks have just been kind of been left to fend for themselves, because they say, okay, that's not for me, so there's nowhere left for me to turn. And so what we're trying to do is a lot of community outreach, and as we were talking before, also training for other providers, for other government agencies, to let folks know that our resources are available, and to establish that we're a safe space, that we're trauma-informed, that we provide folks services to folks regardless of their sexual orientation, of their race, of their ethnicity, of their religious belief, and establishing that trust so that they can feel comfortable coming to us at their most vulnerable moment, because that's what's really hard, right, is that we're expecting folks in a moment of crisis to just be completely trusting of a stranger and telling them about the worst moment of their life.
Well, Ms. Hanau, I've got to stop there. I am completely out of time, but I want to thank you also, Ms. Archie, and Dr. Tonya Stafford Manning for talking to us about this very important topic. Ladies, again, thank you so much. That is the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, April 25th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.